Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
All right, welcome back. Great to have you with us. Second hour of the show here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. I'm in the Sunbury Motors Studio. Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. In just a few moments, we'll be joined by Matt Leon from KYW in Philadelphia. We'll review what happened with the Eagles and the Seahawks on Sunday and look ahead to the Monday night game with the Green Bay Packers. Final half hour of the show, Chris Soleri will join us from the Detroit Free Press as we take a long look at Michigan State. Last night in Mexico City, the Texans were ripped off of a touchdown on the opening series of the game. Just a horrible call by the officials. And don't give me this real-time stuff, because guess what? I'm watching the game last night, and in real time, when Sean McDonough said, they say he stepped out to 36, I'm sitting there saying, where did he step out? I didn't see him step out. I didn't see him step out at all. I did not think Hopkins stepped out at all in real time. And it turned out that obviously, you know, they couldn't replay it because the whistle blew. Well, lousy call. Texans lose the game 27-20. They did get a field goal out of it, so it would have changed the situation at the end to the point where the Texans still would have needed a touchdown to win. But bad call and another bad night for NFL officials. You got to let some plays go and let it play to the end in case there is something. But they evidently thought he stepped out of bounds. He did not step out of bounds. But the Texans did rally in the game last night. That brings us to our play-by-play call of the day. The aforementioned Sean McDonough as the Texans and the Raiders come back and take the lead.
I wonder if Merciless, a little out of gas, playing the altitude tonight. Amari Cooper, run after the catch, run into the end zone. Touchdown and the lead for the Oakland Raiders.
Number 10 at the top of the screen with a key block. Poor pursuit angles. You saw McKinney overrun it. And Amari Cooper scorches him.
That's Sean McDonough, John Gruden with the call last night. Our play-by-play call today is the Raiders rallied to beat the Houston Texans last night in Mexico City. The final was 27-20. Let's stick with the National Football League. And time to bring in Matt Leon from KYW in Philadelphia. Matt, great to have you with us on the show today. Seahawks beat the Eagles. Now Philadelphia gets ready for Green Bay. First of all, Matt, to you and yours, a very happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, my friend.
Appreciate that very much. Timing means a lot. Bad day, bad time to get the Seattle Seahawks.
I think it's interesting that this is a game that pretty much universally everybody in this town assumed the Eagles were going to lose. And then the Eagles go out and lose, and now everyone is freaking out. I don't quite understand.
Right, yeah.
It would have been a Hail Mary for them to win this game. Did they not look good after the, you know, about halfway through the second quarter, Seattle really grabbed control of the game, and the second half really wasn't that competitive. Is that disconcerting? Yeah, but Seattle's playing well. Seattle is just so much better that Seattle would have had to really play a C-minus D game for the Eagles to win this one. That didn't happen. This doesn't change anything. I think I said this to you last week, that as far as I could see, the Seattle Green Bay, they have to win one of these two. So now they have to win the game on Monday night. If they lose that, then real trouble. But if they win that, I think they still got a shot at a wild card.
Yeah, and I think they've got a real shot at the wild card too, especially the way they play. And Green Bay is not playing well. I mean, Green Bay has given up, I think, what, 30-plus points? I want to say it's, what, five games in a row, and they haven't done that since the 1950s. I mean, we talk about timing with Seattle being bad. Timing with Green Bay might be good.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think we've now got enough of context here and enough games in the bank that the Eagles are a completely different team at home. You kind of throw away what you see on the road because when they play at home, they have an elite defense. They have a defense that's top five. They should be able, I mean, Green Bay still has Aaron Rodgers, still has some weapons, even though they are more dysfunctional offensively than they've been in years. They're going to move the football, but I have complete confidence that because the game's being played at the Link, the Eagles defense will be able to control that Packer offense to a point, and the Packers defense is terrible, and the Eagles should be able to score some points. So I'm very optimistic about this one for the Eagles. I think it matches up well for them.
I think it's only one start for Goff out with the Rams, but what did that start tell Philadelphia fans and you about how good Wentz actually is?
Well, it tells you that the Eagles, I don't say make the right choice because it was obviously made for them, right. But it's pretty obvious that the Eagles got the much better quarterback. I watched some of that game for the Rams, and you don't want to, you know, pile on Jared Goff, but this was a guy they really struggled completing anything more than 5-6 yards past the line of scrimmage. You know, was just checking down on everything. And when you see where the Eagles are with Wentz, you know, he's just so much further ahead than Jared Goff. If I'm an Eagles fan, in the big picture, I just feel very good after seeing that. It kind of reaffirms what anyone that's watched this team already knew, that the Eagles are in good shape at quarterback and, you know, definitely got the better of the top two at the top of the draft.
Matt, when Doug Peterson talks with the media and Wentz is brought up, what are some of the qualities that he points out as a coach that he appreciates in him?
I think the knowledge of the game or the studying of the game, how he, you know, he's pointed out, it's not brought up as much now, but early in the season he was quick to point out that Wentz was one of the first guys in or the first guy in at 5:30 in the morning watching film on the day off. And then as far as on the field, I think progressions, you know, understanding what they are trying to do. He doesn't hesitate to tell Doug Peterson what he's seeing on the field. I think a lot of those things kind of all figure into why they like him so much, aside from the obvious talent.
Have you seen any change in Doug Peterson as a play caller? And what, you know, and I base that on the fact that there were a couple games where people questioned his play calling. So did he make any adjustments?
Oh, I think so. I think it was very right to question his play calling. Specifically, you look at the Giants in the Dallas game, and they just got out of whack.
Completely agree with you, yes.
Yeah, completely got away from what they did well. And then against Atlanta, you saw them pound the run, work off of that. I don't want to say they made Wentz a game manager, but they didn't force him to win the game. Because you've also got to remember that Wentz is, they're throwing to probably the – one of the three worst sets of wide receivers in the NFL.
Right.
So they don't do anything to generate anything on the outside. So it is very difficult to move the football 6-7 yards at a time up and down the field. And even yesterday in Seattle, I questioned a little bit. They kind of came out firing, and I just didn't see the point of that because if the wide receivers can't win battles one-on-one against secondaries like Atlanta and Washington, they ain't going to do it in Seattle, and that was proven right. And they were able to run the ball a little bit. The one early touchdown drive they had was a very well-conceived, well-executed ball control drive. So you saw, you know, that Peterson can still is still doing that as far as building off what they do well. And to be fair, I still think they lose the game yesterday,
right.
But they had that silly Nelson Agholor penalty where he doesn't line up on the line of scrimmage, and it negates a 57-yard catch-and-run touchdown for Zach Ertz. If that play stands, and, you know, you hate to say what if with penalties, but I think that's one you can safely say that we would have had the same result had Nelson Agholor moved up 7 inches at the line of scrimmage prior to the snap. Now the Eagles lead 14-13. Maybe Seattle starts to press a little bit because it's getting close to halftime and they're losing to a team they're supposed to beat. And I still think Seattle was so much the better team, but you could have seen a different dynamic play out. And once you kind of got into the second half, the play calling kind of was all over the place because it had to be, because you could tell that game was spinning out of control and spinning away from them.
Do they have too much money invested in Agholor, or is he somebody that should be on a constant watch as to whether he's with the team shortly?
I mean, I wouldn't be through. I would look for him to be deactivated this week for the Packers game. They actually just activated Paul Turner, who was a training camp phenom, off the practice squad to the active roster. I would imagine they are doing that so they at least have the option of having Nelson Agholor take a week off. But he's all over the place mentally right now. You could just tell from his post-game comments. I still wouldn't cut him. Number one, it is a cap hit. And I've seen some of the numbers. I don't remember them. But it's a pretty significant cap hit they have in dead money.
No, it's huge.
Yeah. But, you know, he was not a reach as a first-round pick. You know, he was not Danny Watkins. He was not Marcus Smith. He was not a guy that when his name was called, everyone kind of looked at each other and said, you know, what's going on here? He was taken right around where people thought he was going to go. And if you needed a wide receiver in that part of the draft, he was one of the first names mentioned. So that's what's so maddening about this. You know, if the Eagles missed on this, they weren't the only ones, because he was not a reach at that situation. I don't think he is going to turn into anything more than an average NFL player, but I still wouldn't quite give up on him when you throw in the financial risks, and you just hope that maybe the light goes on one of these days and he can and be close to what people thought he could be.
Give me a gauge as to what Malcolm Jenkins has meant on that defense.
Oh, he means a lot. I mean, Fletcher Cox is probably the most talented player.
No question.
But I think Jenkins is the heart and soul. And he's the heart and soul in the locker room, too. I mean, he's a guy that, they go to. He's always available after the game for comments. Had some things to say. He didn't sugarcoat it with, like, the Agholor penalty. You know, he says, you know, this is the NFL. We should know how to line up at this point. You know, and I think people like respect that. And on the field, he's been very good. I mean, he's kind of the quarterback of the defense back there. Rodney McLeod had a poor game against Seattle. It's one of the first ones he's had this year. But one of the reasons specifically at home the defense has been so good has been the play of the safety, specifically Jenkins.
Yeah, no, I mean, no question. You mentioned playing at home. Playing at home, as you mentioned earlier, they've been great.
Yeah.
I've always felt that young developing teams, that's the first step for them. I don't care what sport it is. Win at home. Then it starts to translate down the road as you get better and better. What is it about playing there that has allowed this team, especially some of the younger players, to respond?
Your guess is really as good as mine. I mean, I'm sure that it's obviously more energy and more excitement. And now it is probably to the point where it is a mental thing, whereas they have had so much success at home, you now start to expect to have success at home. Just like conversely, they've struggled on the road, so now you're kind of waiting for the first bad thing to happen on the road, and like when the Earth touchdown gets called back, and when it does, everything just completely falls apart. So that's the biggest thing. I mean, they've actually probably played better teams at home, you know, all in all, as far as quality of play. But they have been a different team at home than they have been on the road. And specifically, offensively, they've pretty much done the same thing, you know, as far as move the football, scoring points or whatever. It's the defense that it's really night and day. They're not terrible on the road, but they're pedestrian. When they're at home, they're dominant. They are a top five defense at home. When you figure they played three really good, the pretty good, the really good teams in Pittsburgh, Atlanta, and Minnesota. And in those three games, they allowed a total of two offensive touchdowns, one of which came in garbage time. It's a completely different unit when they're at the link.
But where does the crowd make its most noise? Pre-snap. It's always when the defense is out there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just amazing to be this stark of a difference. Not just the record. It's not just the record. It's the types of games they play at home and away.
The key is, though, is they've got to eliminate mistakes. That's what cost them yesterday. Cost the Eagles yesterday. When it was all said and done. And that's that. Seattle won. Mistakes by Philadelphia contributed.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. And really silly mistakes. I mean, I just keep coming to that, you know, to that penalty, the drop passes.
Yeah.
I mean, things that you can control, you know, stuff like that. You're going to have ebb and flow, but it was a frustrating game to watch.
Well, always a pleasure, my friend. Great to hear you on the other end. And then they've got Green Bay next Monday night. So we're looking
forward to it. Should be interesting.
Should be very interesting at what should be a fired up link. I hope you have a great Thanksgiving. You deserve it.
As do I for you and yours, sir. Happy holidays. I'll talk to you next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, Matt. Matt Leon, KYW in Philadelphia. Always great to have him on the show. Give us the perspective on the Eagles, just as Tony DeFazio and Neil Coulon give us the Steeler perspective. We get the Eagle perspective from Matt Leon every week. And, of course, you hear the Eagles on Eagle 107. Final half hour, Chris Solari, Detroit Free Press, will be joining us to talk about Michigan State. They fought Ohio State right to the wire last week. Went for two. With about, I don't know, 4.5, 4:50 to go in the game, they went for two, didn't make it. And in fact, if you look at the All-22 on that, which I, you know, obviously I have access to, that play isn't even close. Yeah. Well, we'll get into that with Chris Solari in just a few minutes on the show in the final half hour of the show. Meanwhile, Penn State basketball tomorrow night. The Nittany Lions will take on Colgate at the Jordan Center. Josh Reeves will be back tomorrow night for Penn State. It'll be his first game of the season. It's just another important component of what Patrick Chambers is trying to do. And Patrick Chambers, it'll be Patrick Chambers and James Franklin tonight on the Penn State Coaches Show from Letterman's, the Penn State Coaches Show featuring James Franklin. The first half of the show will be Patrick Chambers tonight, and the second half of the show tonight will be James Franklin. Saturday's game in Beaver Stadium will be a 3:30 kickoff. We'll be on the air with the Dietz and Watson Tailgate Show at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon. We'll be on outside the Jordan Ticket Center and then into the booth for the showdown with Michigan State. The Michigan-Ohio State game will be at noon. Everyone will know the result of that game when Penn State takes the field for Senior Day. There are 17 seniors, including managers, that will be saluted before the Penn State game on Saturday. These seniors stuck it out. Now, I think there are four of them that were actually recruited and had started the recruiting process with Joe Paterno. Malik Golden's one. And they had started the recruiting process with Joe Paterno. Never practiced or played for him, but the recruiting process was started by Joe and his staff. They'll run through the tunnel for the final time as well on Saturday. So these seniors have given a lot. They've been through a lot. These seniors have been through a couple of coaches, through the change, had to buy into what was going on with the James Franklin program after buying in with what Bill O'Brien was doing. And, you know, and through it all, they've conducted themselves in an exemplary way. Yesterday was a good example. They were out doing community service yesterday. Believe me, they were doing a lot of football work. There was weight room work yesterday. There was a lot of film work done yesterday. And they did a lot of community service yesterday. They parsed it among the team as to who went where. But, for example, Saquon Barkley went out to a school in red yesterday. So it wasn't just, hey, we're going to send the walk-ons out to take care of this. They sent all the players out yesterday to do community service. And that's just a hallmark of a program giving back. It's really important. Patrick Chambers did the same thing with his players yesterday for Penn State basketball, giving back during Thanksgiving week. And I think it's important that it's not just giving back. As a sign of, okay, look, we're doing good works in the community, even though the program is not winning tons of games. Well, the program is winning. They're winning a lot of games, and they're giving back, and that tells you how thankful they are to the fans. And the fans have meant everything to this program. The fans have meant everything. And I've talked about this now. I think for 4 years now I've talked about this, either on the show or speaking to various groups. Penn State is where it is right now at 9-2 with a 7-game winning streak because of several factors. Because of the job that James Franklin has done, the job his staff has done, the players that they've brought in, the style of play and how he's adjusted the style of play with the coaching changes that he made. And a big part of this is that through it all, and the fact that the players have bought into what's going on. He's had support from the administration. Obviously, the players Joe Paterno recruited allowed Bill O'Brien to keep things afloat during his time, and the players that Bill O'Brien recruited are now helping this team now, some of the older players, without question. But the fans have stuck in there. When remember, when all of this came down, everyone said Beaver Stadium would end up being a ghost town and Penn State would be winning three or four games a year. Well, Beaver Stadium has never come close to being a ghost town. It has been alive, energetic, and the fans have been passionate about Penn State football. Now the reward is the fans who have been so influential in getting the program to this point now get this game Saturday in Beaver Stadium. And the stakes, based on the Ohio State-Michigan game, could be very, very high for Penn State. They're very high anyway. I mean, you still want to cap this off and get a 10th win regardless, but the door is open for bigger and better things. All right, Chris Solari will talk about Michigan State next half hour. We're in the Sunbury Motors studio, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf, on News Radio 1070 WKOK. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back, Sports Bozo of the Day. Well, to the officials in last night's game in Mexico City, DeAndre Tompkins, he scored in that play in real time, live. I'm watching this, I'm thinking he didn't step out of bounds. And Sean McDonough, of course, you know, he has to say what the officials ruled. And he said, look, shows he stepped out of bounds at the 36. Or they say he stepped out of bounds at the 36. I'm watching this in real time. I think he didn't step out of bounds. And when you look at the replay, he did not step out of bounds. Big play, bad call, and another bad night for the NFL when it comes to that. You know, on a celebratory night, obviously, in Mexico City. All right, let's turn our attention to Saturday, Beaver Stadium, Penn State and Michigan State. Chris Solari joins us from the Detroit Free Press. Chris, welcome back. It is great to hear you again.
Well, glad to join you. It's kind of a lot different than the last time we talked, I think.
I think so. Number one, let's straighten something out here first. That way we, you know, we're all on the same page here. You are not in charge of the clock at basketball, right?
No, I'm one of the few people apparently that didn't have a stop timer there that last night. The Big Ten had to issue a statement that it was one of the game officials, not the timekeeper, which, you know, folks around here, you know, whether it's the basketball team dealing with that in 86 against Kansas or 90 against Georgia Tech or, you know, Michigan State football back in I think, 2001. I mean, there's been a lot of clock issues in these parts, so they're a little testy and temperamental towards that.
I can understand that completely. All right, Chris, let's start with Michigan State and Damian Terry. You wrote an article saying, you know what, it's just time to just give him a shot and let him play the whole thing. What are your reasons behind that?
Well, we really haven't seen enough, really, to get a gauge on Damian Terry. He's been interspersed here and there. Really, the only legitimate playing time that he had was when Tyler O'Connor went out against Illinois a couple weeks ago, and he let a touchdown drive late, looked like Michigan State had a win, defense let him down, and then he got sacked on fourth down the ensuing drive. But, you know, he was one of those guys that came in with so much hype and promise from Erie Cathedral Prep, and he fits the bill athletically. He's a guy that likes to run the ball, more of a power runner maybe than necessarily a speed runner like a JT Barrett. But a guy that also has an arm, you know, we've seen him throw it downfield and miss. but he's never really had a chance to build that rhythm. And if you want to get Damian Terry back next year, if you want to prevent him from leaving and leave you with a gap at the veteran quarterback spot, I think you got to give him a shot. You got, at this point, there's nothing left for a 3-8 Michigan State team to lose here. You need to see if Damian Terry does have maybe what it takes to be the starter next year, or at the minimum, keep him interested, keep him engaged, and keep him as a veteran backup, a package guy, whatever it may be, because I think there's, you've seen that on the market now in college football, where a lot of guys are leaving. They get their degree, and then they go play somewhere else where their services are wanted. So I think it's imperative for Michigan State to do that, at least to see what Terry's got.
Interesting with him, you mentioned him as a runner. I think he's a good runner, very good. As a thrower of the football, is it the fact that he's not a great thrower of the football, or is it because, look, we're going to put you in here, put you in there, and he doesn't get a chance to develop any rhythm? Which one is it?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that the knock on him, you know, there's been two knocks on him here at Michigan State. One is his health. He gets dinged up quite a bit. But secondly, it's been his decision-making more so than his arm strength. I think he's got a tremendous arm. We saw him throw a couple deep balls. He overshot his target by maybe a half yard or so, and I think that's kind of a rhythm thing. I think when you get more of a chance to throw and be in an offense and run in the show, you have that rhythm. You develop that rhythm, which he's never really gotten the chance to do. I think he's got a good arm. I think he's got a better arm than Tyler O'Connor does. Maybe not as good as Brian Lewerke, who broke his leg and he's out for the rest of the season, the redshirt freshman. But he has an adequate Division I arm. I think it's, you know, an average to above average Division I arm. So, you know, he's a guy that really helped recruit a lot of the guys in his class, his redshirt junior class, and has been a leader, been a program guy. And you know, going home to Pennsylvania, I mean, we all know that you know, when you grow up in Pennsylvania, Beaver Stadium means something, you know, whether you're a Penn State fan or not. You know, there's only one place in that state where 100,000 people will gather for anything, and that's it. So I think that's actually a big thing as well. You know, here's a guy who sat all year and waited for a chance. You have nothing left to gain with Tyler O'Connor. He's a fifth-year senior. His career's over. You really need to see what your future is and if Damian Terry is part of that.
If O'Connor does play, and you know Mark D'Antonio, I don't, but say he does play, what has kept him from thriving? Because I know I watched the All-22 this morning, and I thought he made some good throws. I thought he made some questionable decisions. And on the two-point play, no offense, that's not even close. I mean, you look at it from the end zone view, that's not even close to being complete.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, the tight end he was throwing to was supposed to throw to was covered. He saw the second tight end there, maybe about a half second to a second late, and then tried to force it in. I don't think he has the arm strength to do that. You know, I mean, he's not a rocket arm guy to thread the needle through traffic like that. And really, I mean, the decision to do it, to go for two there, I like that call. I just yep. didn't necessarily like the play that they dialed up, especially the way LJ Scott was running the ball. They didn't do anything out of play action. They went straight shotgun and sent Scott out in the pattern as a safety valve. You know, they put it on O'Connor's arm and it failed, and they threw an interception to end the game, missed two open receivers underneath that could have got out of bounds. You know, that's a decision thing as well as a physical thing, throwing deep into the really gusty wind. You know, and that's kind of been O'Connor's knock all year is, you know, part of it's been, you know, he hasn't had a lot of time, you know, with the problems in pass protection Michigan State had. And part of it's just he's made bad throws. He's underthrown a lot of receivers all year, even all the way back to the Notre Dame game. I mean, people remember the big catch that freshman Donnie Corley made in the end zone. He basically mm-hmm. pulled away another interception there. It would have been that would have been the 10th interception of the year for O'Connor. So, I mean, it's, you know, he's been a valiant soldier. He obviously no doubt. Got the win at Ohio State last year, but right now, I think they got to think of the future.
All right. The running game generated over 200 plus in four of the last five games, and LJ Scott's coming off another really good game. What are you seeing up front and from LJ Scott as the primary back?
Well, I think that, you know, as much as the offensive line has struggled in pass protection, they've really turned the corner in run blocking, and they've used a lot of younger guys. I mean, some of the veterans that they've still had there, Brian Allen's a junior. He's had an exceptional year. They moved him around from left guard to right guard in a couple different spots. Cody Keeler's had up and down year as the tackle spots. They've moved him around. But they've got redshirt freshman Cole Chewins now playing left tackle. And he's done a fairly solid job for a guy who needs to still put on some weight to play at this level. But, you know, the reality is Scott is a feature back, and that's kind of what they recruited him as. Gerald Holmes has been kind of a battering ram and had enough good games where you see his promise and potential and I guess the way he helps his offense. But Scott's the guy that's got the wiggle. I think they recruited him with the idea that he reminded them of Le'Veon Bell. I think you saw that. You know, not just the leap that he had over one of the Ohio State defenders in that game, yeah. but also, I mean, just the way the wiggle he has, the way he's able to run through contact, you know, push the pile a couple extra yards if you need it. You know, ball security, I think, has been kind of problematic at times. He hasn't fumbled a lot, but when he has, they've been costly and gone the other way for points. So something to keep in mind this weekend, but he's certainly lived up to the billing now, really since the Maryland game. He's a guy that's a feature back and a guy to watch here in the next couple of years.
They try to get the ball to Shelton. It looks like they try to give him like 10 to 15 touches in a variety of ways. How important is motion and deception for Michigan State's offense?
It's critical, and I think, you know, when you watch that, the second play of the game, the one that Scott caught the touchdown pass and went 4 yards, that was all predicated on R.J. Shelton going in motion to the right side in that jet sweep after running a jet sweep. I think that's really where they thrive on. I mean, and Shelton's been, you know, the way that Michigan State has struggled this year, his senior season hasn't gone the way he wanted, but he's been a productive weapon. He's probably been the most productive and consistent threat that Michigan State has had, whether they give him the ball on the run or they do those little flip passes out of jet motion. Haven't had enough time to really go downfield, but in the Indiana game against Northwestern, O'Connor found him deep. So, I mean, he is a deep threat as well.
He sure is. No, he sure is. Youth movement on defense up front, fair to say?
That's probably an understatement.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at where this team was on game one to now, the parts have all changed. You know, Malik McDowell's out with, you know, whether it's an ankle injury or a rib injury or something else. You know, who knows? I mean, it looks like he's probably on his way to the NFL after this year. So they've been starting two freshmen, a true freshman and a redshirt freshman, Raekwon Williams and Mike Kanishuk, defensive tackle. They've both really turned the corner here the past 2 or 3 weeks. I think you're seeing some more pressure from the ends. They've started to put Austin Robertson out there. They put Josh King out there. Those are two true freshmen. They've got Demetrius Cooper, who's a junior. And really, two guys in the sophomore class who've kind of come on the last couple games are Robert Bowers and Dylan Alexander, two guys that we didn't even have on our radar back in August and September. Guys that have really taken, I guess, the chip mindset that Mark D'Antonio has promoted and played their way into roles in this defense. So still young, still developing. I mean, Mike Weber and J.T. Barrett gassed them for over 100 yards. So, I mean, they still gave up some yardage, but, you know, I think you're going to see that with any young defensive line like that. And they had so much attrition to guys leaving for the NFL, guys transferring, guys being kicked off the team, whatever it may be. So they're finally starting to kind of get into midseason form. Unfortunately for them, it's now game 12.
How much is they miss John Reschke?
You know, I think Reschke's a big part of it. I think that, you know, you saw what he did in that Notre Dame game. He missed the first game with a hand injury. He had a pick in the game against Notre Dame. He was really good in run support. Then he got hurt against Wisconsin. You know, I don't necessarily know. He's a blitzer, kind of like Fry and Bulla. So you had another component there. I think that the problems, though, I think were too great on the line for much of the year to really, it wouldn't have mattered if John Reschke was in there or not. But I think if they get him as an extra year now with a medical, because he had a medical situation as a true freshman, it's one of those things where I think they'll keep him around for another year or two now. And I think that'll only benefit his defense because he's a guy that's got a lot of different skills at that linebacker spot and can really bounce to either outside spot.
I think an underrated thing for Michigan State the last few years has been their special teams. Where is that right now?
It's abysmal. It's funny because, you know, we think about a couple of years ago back when Keyshawn Martin was the punt returner and they were able to really flip the field with him. You know, he went on to have the NFL career with the Texans, and I think last I saw he was with the Patriots.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, they haven't found a punt returner. They haven't found, you know, Shelton, I think Shelton had the last touchdown by a return man, and that was at Penn State a couple of years.
I recall it was the opening kickoff.
Yeah.
thanks for the reminder, Chris.
Honestly, though, that's the only return they've had of note in the last 3 years. And, I mean, that's, they've struggled to flip the field, and I think a lot of their offensive situations are dictated by the fact that they're not getting that good field position that they were accustomed to with Connor Cook at quarterback or Kirk Cousins. That's problematic because this is a team that prides itself on special teams. They've had issues in the kicking game, you know, whether it's missed field goals from Michael Geiger or kickoffs out of bounds by Kevin Cronin or short punts or long punts by Jake Hartbarger. I mean, it's a mixed bag. But, I mean, they've had a lot of special teams issues for a team that really, as you said, prides itself and has had a strong foundation of being a good special teams unit. They just really struggled the last few years.
And Cronin's kicked six out of bounds. I mean, six.
It's pretty brutal. It's pretty brutal. And then at the Ohio State game, after they get the touchdown and miss the 2-point conversion, he's supposed to kick a squib kick deep in the middle of the field. Instead, he kicks it short, and that ends up costing them field position there when they make the stop. And all these things are interconnected. And Mark D'Antonio has said this all year: it's not one thing; it's a collection of things. And really, when Michigan State does have its mistakes, it's one unit or another, or two of the three. And, that's what happens when you see a 3-8 record and close games that you can't really pull off, like the Ohio State game or the Illinois game, or really even the Michigan game for how close they came and kind of defied a lot of expectations in that.
What are your thoughts, obviously, on Penn State?
Well, I'll tell you that I think back to last year, and, and I know that it's got to be burning in James Franklin's craw and his players' craw about Jack Allen getting that rushing touchdown. That's the first thing that pops into my head. When an offensive lineman gets a rushing touchdown on you, if there's any greater motivator, I don't know what it is, just simply from a football standpoint. But I think that they saw Saquon Barkley last year, and I think he was one of the best running backs I saw as a true freshman. Now, I guess we're going to wait and see maybe with what happened after the Rutgers game. It seems like he should be okay, and I think that presents a challenge for Michigan State, especially that young defense. If he can get into that second level and open some things up in the passing game for McSorley, I do believe that Penn State should be able to handle Michigan State. But then again, you look at what this team has done in defying odds against Michigan and really having Ohio State right on the ropes. I don't count out Mark D'Antonio.
No, I don't think anybody does when it comes to that. When it comes to the read option, obviously Ohio State runs it a little bit different than Penn State because they use, Weber's used as a lead blocker, for Barrett. Barkley doesn't have to do that as often. But how have they handled read option this year, RPO?
Well, that's been one of the bigger issues, and I think that's the result of having young players. It's actually a twofold issue. First of all, the young players don't know their assignments and are missing or kind of out of sorts on plays, and then the older players are trying to overcompensate, and so then they like Riley Buller and Illinois gets blocked out of a play on an RPO, or Chris Fry is having to chase from behind and getting hedged off a block, or one of the defensive backs, I think like Monte Nicholson last week, misread Barrett and blew his assignment and left Demetrius Cox exposed in the back end for a touchdown pass to Samuel. So I mean, it isn't simply just the younger players, but I think those older players, because they've experienced so much success and they haven't been enjoying it, they've really forced themselves to overexert with what they're supposed to do and get out of their roles, get out of their assignments. Now, that's the thing that they've preached. Gap sound football, especially against RPOs. They've got to be able to do that this week. Otherwise, it could go south in a hurry for them.
One other thing I'll bring up, then I'll let you go, and that will be the Michigan State does not – it goes back to the defensive line. But I think they only have 10 sacks by that front this year. And, of course, I mean, what difference has that made for the secondary, the fact that they only have 10 sacks?
Well, not only do they only have 10 sacks, they got three against Ohio State, and that was I counted it up. They played 284 minutes of football without a sack. That's, I mean, just think about that at the major college level and for a defense like that. You leave your, when you have your cornerbacks out on an island like that, they're 100% reliant on getting pressure, moving the pocket, collapsing it, getting it up the middle. And I think it all starts up the middle. Especially we've seen that in Michigan State's defense in 2013, 14, and 15. When they get the push up the middle, then the edge guys can disrupt some things, and it allows those corners to stay on an island. And really, you have to pick your poison if you're going to throw deep on them of which safety you want to go to. They've struggled in coverage. I mean, the cornerbacks have been in and out. You know, they've got a true freshman playing at cornerback now in Justin Lane, a converted receiver. Mm-hmm. They're moving Donnie Corley around to both sides of the ball. You know, there's been issues. I feel like they've shorted up a little bit here in the past few weeks. It's not like they've had teams beating them over the top, but they've had to also play soft, so they get beat underneath, and then that's when things really go awry in the secondary.
Chris, an absolute pleasure. You gave us a lot of time today. I appreciate it very much. I look forward to seeing you Saturday.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Going to get home to Butler for a little bit of Thanksgiving, bring the kid back, go around Western Pennsylvania, and then head out Saturday morning.
That is a great weekend. Great plan. Happy Thanksgiving,
really,
by the way. Happy Thanksgiving, by
you
the way.
You as well. Thanks. You guys as well. We'll see you Saturday.
Chris Solari, Detroit Free Press. Of course, the game Saturday will be at 3:30 kickoff. We'll be on the air with the Dietz and Watson tailgate show at 2 o'clock here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. The News Hour starring Jennifer Wakeman coming up in just a few minutes, and then I'll be back in an hour at Letterman's Sports Grill and Gastropub with the Penn State Coaches Show featuring James Franklin, Patrick Chambers first half hour, James Franklin final half hour. Thanks for joining us today in the Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf on News Radio 1070 WKOK.